All right. Hi, everyone. Logistics, right, look pretty similar. Just a reminder, next Tuesday is the exam review day. We're gonna do that just like we did the midterm, where please bring questions. We'll answer questions as long as there's questions. Okay, so we're following up from Tuesday's class, where we started looking at this type of attack called a side channel, where we can't observe something directly, but we cause something to happen that we're interested in, and then we can observe its effects. And we looked at this specifically in the context of a timing attack using caches, with the sort of intuition that if I can access something in a cache, it should be faster than accessing it in memory, and I can observe that and see what the processor is doing, even if the processor won't actually give me the value that I asked for. We're gonna build on that by looking at two attacks that were discovered in the last decade or so. I can't remember exactly when it was, but that sort of used this type of attack vector in a couple interesting ways. Before we dive in, anything before we get started? Nope. All right, cool. All right, so we kind of looked at this example before, but this time we're going to dive more in depth here, right? And but last time we were sort of looking at this if statement here and saying, okay, depending on whether or not we see something change with memory by observing it in the cache, that can tell us something about what happened with mystery or what mystery was. However, as we kind of alluded to, there's other reasons that the contents of this if statement, this like memory access here, might happen or maybe might start happening. Because if the processor has to make a decision, does it think that if statement's gonna evaluate to true and it should execute instructions inside the if statement, or does it think it should execute or it think it'll evaluate to false and it should skip over it? And it wants to do this speculation because that's where the out-of-order processor design is gonna keep having instructions that it can potentially reorder and sort of keep itself busy. So we can see this example of what happens if the processor predicts, again, it's never gonna be fully sure, but it thinks that mystery is going to be true. So here's sort of our setup for the assembly instructions to set up that if statement, and this is our out-of-order design, right, where we can have two things in the fetch stage at the same time. Okay, so that's fine. It might take a while to do this, and then we get to this jump instruction, and again, this is where the processor has to decide. Does it think it's gonna be taken or not? In this case, it says, no, this is not gonna be taken. We're not gonna go to skip. I'm just gonna keep executing instructions, and then what we see here is that sort of pointer access, right? We're loading the value of the pointer into the register and then using that to access memory. Okay, none of this is sort of different than what we saw before. Now, what we observe is that this instruction here, the memory access, actually gets issued and goes to the execute stage, like we're gonna read that. Because if mystery is true, then that's exactly what the processor should do. Now, we know that mystery was not true and that the skip should have happened and that if statement should not execute. And that sort of matches what we see here, right? Because there's no commit. Because from the programmer's point of view, that if statement didn't happen, and we definitely don't want it to look like it did. So from executing the programmer's intent, this is totally fine. But even though we were never supposed to execute this instruction, internally, in the microarchitectural state of the processor, it started. And it's possible that that got far enough that it was actually added to the cache. Right? Because the cache is this internal optimization inside the processor. It doesn't change what this actual code is going to look like in terms of what those register values are or if the memory gets updated. Because, like, as we see, right, like this part, the add and the write here, that doesn't actually happen. So this idea of speculation leads to things happening even if the code says they shouldn't. Good with that? Okay, but there's, you know, there is a sort of an issue here, right? Which is that, like, well, okay, but, I mean, it shouldn't have happened, right? The if statement, if it evaluates to false, it shouldn't execute. So how can we maybe bend things in our favor? How can we get the processor to think that this if statement will actually be executed? Any ideas? So the processor might not know. I mean, it's the actual decision there might require some other operations. But when it gets to the point where it wants to fetch the jump instruction and then decide what the instruction after that's going to be, it has to make a decision. It's got to guess. How might we influence what that guess is likely to be? An idea?
I have an idea, but I think it's right. With an instruction, maybe, an assembly that's like special.
Okay, with an instruction, kind of. So we don't really have an instruction to directly like influence the branch predictor of the processor. But we can do something similar. Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a great idea. So the branch predictor, and we talked about some simple designs, but sort of intuitively, right, the branch predictor is going to kind of, you know, in some way look at what's happened before and then try to make a prediction based on that. Right? And we do this all the time. You know, we make assumptions and guesses about what's going to happen based on what's happened in the past. Processor can do the same thing. So what if we run some instructions which happen to show it that this if statement is taken, or that this if statement does execute? And we do that a bunch of times, over and over and over again. Say we do it 100 times. What's the chances on the 101st time that it won't execute? Right? So we can sort of prime the branch predictor to do what we want by giving it a bunch of examples of what we expect, and then we sort of switch it on it. All right. And so we can use this in the sort of a structure. So if we have an if statement, again, that's actually not supposed to execute, but inside of it, there's a memory access. And again, that memory access won't like fully complete because it shouldn't have, right? The if statement says it shouldn't have. But if the processor speculates incorrectly, starts executing inside that if statement, and starts doing that memory access, and that's then observable through the cache, right? Now we have a way to tell what happened. even though, again, from like the programmer's point of view, like that code should never have executed. Any questions on that? Okay, so what can we do with this? Well, let's go back to sort of our setup that we were looking at last time. So remember we talked about prime and probe? So prime being, we set up the cache in a certain way, we're gonna fill it with values. Then we let something happen that hopefully will change the cache in some way, and then we go back and probe it and see what changed. Did something go from fast because it was in the cache to now it's evicted, so it's slower? And can we use that, right? Okay, now we have our if statement, and so if we can trick the processor, or the processor just makes the wrong prediction and speculatively executes what's inside here. Now, it's even possible that the first operation here is something that should cause a seg fault. It's a memory access we shouldn't be allowed to do. But maybe the processor doesn't know that, or at least not right away. And so again, in the interest of continuing to execute speculatively so that we're doing as much as we possibly can, and it goes on to actually then use this pointer, which now really shouldn't have happened because we know that the if statement shouldn't have executed, and we shouldn't have advanced past where we did the seg fault. And so if those things happen, then we might be able to observe that effect. Even though, again, it shouldn't have happened. And so that's where we get this side channel, because we're doing something that we shouldn't be able to see directly, but it might have effects in the cache, and if we can observe it in the cache, then we can still learn what's going on. Okay, so what does this look like? So remember, for a particular memory access, we have to do the address translation, but then we also need to check if you're even allowed to access that physical memory. And we talked about page tables and how operating systems will use them. They often will have kernel-owned memory in the page table as well, so that when the kernel needs to access it, it can be really fast, because it uses the same page table setup that was loaded when the process was executing. But it's just marked so that only the kernel can access those pages. Well, if these steps are decoupled, so the actual translation, like we saw from the homework, is separate from checking the permissions, what does that enable? Well, then we can do something like here. So we still have our prime and probe, right? And we have this if statement, which shouldn't actually execute, right? Because it actually should be false, but the processor doesn't know that. It thinks it's going to be true, and so it starts executing what's inside. Now, what's inside is this operation, which is trying to read something from memory that that this process should not have access to. But if the processor doesn't know that right away, and wants to do the work just in case, you know, maybe it is allowed. It goes, starts that, it does that read, and then that value is then used again here as the index to an array, which if we know where that is and can observe, like, okay, what cache line or cache set should that have affected? So we're not actually gonna get the value. Like, we're not gonna be able to see that because the processor's gonna realize its mistake before it actually like gives that value to us. But if it's used internally in this second lookup, and that then changes the cache, and we can observe where that changed in the cache, we can basically work our way backwards to figure out what this value actually was, which is, again, memory that we should not have had access to. And in the last little bit here, this multiply, we'll talk more about this, is basically a way to change which cash row we're in to help with what we're looking at what the actual value is, so we're not confused by the offset. All right. Any questions on this? Yeah. Okay, yeah, why do we need the if statement, right? Because, you know, if we look at this, like, just this part is most relevant. Hold on to that thought for a second. I'll come back to it. Other questions on this type of attack? Yeah. So I think if I could summarize your question, it's basically like, whose fault is this? Right? Is this the processor's fault? Is it the OS's fault? Some combination of the two? Right? And, you know, because, like, there's something about it, like, it matters about the virtual memory, and it matters about the speculation, and it matters about the caches. And so these attacks are really enabled because of the speculation in hardware. And so in some sense, as an OS designer, you might look at this and go, oh, come on, like, I'm doing everything right, I'm writing the right code, and yet this is still vulnerable because the hardware has these speculation and lets these side channels present. But as we'll talk about, sometimes, you know, there's also a really good performance reason to do this, the speculation. And so maybe we want to enable that, and the OS can take additional precautions. So there's going to be trade-offs here. That being said, I think at the end of the day, this is, like, really the fault of the hardware. Like, it's the microarchitectural design that lets this be possible. The OS was kind of doing what it was supposed to be doing. Okay, so we can look at this a little bit more, you know, direct, right? Like, the few assembly instructions we need. And so for this attack to work, we're going to have an address that sort of belongs to the kernel. Oh, by the way, this is the meltdown attack. It's kind of the name given to it by the researchers who discovered it and published it. So we have some kernel address. We can zero out RAX here. And then what we want to do is we want to try to load from that kernel address. Now, this will segfault because we're not allowed to just load a kernel address from user space, right? That's kind of the, you know, one of those bedrock ideas that we talked about earlier in the semester. But we're at least going to try, and the processor is going to sort of speculatively execute that. Then we take the output of that and shift it left. This is that multiply operation so that we get it into a different cache row. This retry is, like, sometimes this doesn't work, and so we basically, if we didn't load anything, we just go and try it again. And then finally, we use the value that we weren't supposed to have access to look up into another array. And that's the array that's going to affect the cache that we're then going to use to try to figure out what that value was. So a couple things, right? So I mentioned kind of the shift left to multiply by 46. That avoids the prefetcher, which we talked a little bit about last time, and helps us figure out which... differentiate things because things that are nearby would be in the same block, and so this splits it into different cache sets. The retry is if it didn't work, if it wasn't quite available, we can try it again. And then finally, that last access is where we actually influence the cache, and then we can use a technique similar to prime and probe, which we'll talk a little bit more about. It's the same general idea, right? We're going to do something to the cache to set it up in a certain way, let the thing happen, and then try to observe the effects. Yeah. Is the problem, the question is the problem here that the processor finishes reading memory before checking if there's a seg fault? Yes, right? The problem is that the processor will use that value in the later instructions speculatively before finishing that check. And so again, like these are not like committed instructions because it wasn't actually supposed to happen. And so the processor will still sort of do the right thing. It's just that this intermediate representation still happens. And what's going on is still visible through the cache. Now, that seg fault will happen eventually. And so we can just kind of keep trying with a... new process, OS will be fine with that. There's also a type of memory where memory accesses are sort of grouped in transactions, and so if this does happen, they would just kind of roll back as a whole group and allow the system to continue. This is also where that if statement can be helpful, because if we can get this to happen inside of a conditional that wasn't supposed to happen, then even though the memory access, if it was intentional, would cause a seg fault, the processor has to go, wait a minute, this wasn't even supposed to run. Like, I mispredicted this branch, and so I can't have a mispredicted branch cause a seg fault. So it's another way to avoid the actual failure while still having the effects visible. All right. And so how to fix this, right? How to address this? This... particular issue, what isn't necessarily, wasn't an issue on all hardware. Intel CPUs were vulnerable. And so now newer versions of the chip don't do this. Once you know about it, it's like, oh, well, of course we shouldn't have allowed that. There's generally also a software version of these types of fixes, where software can take some mediating action to avoid this to be visible. However, this is usually the trade-off, right? So the OS kind of has to decide, how is this attack something that I'm willing to sacrifice performance for to address? How likely is this attack to happen? How much will my users care? And so there's often a trade-off, especially when it's first, when it's a hardware issue like this, we can't just sort of fix that overnight, right? Software is still hard to patch, but at least we can send an update. Hardware, we still have to wait for the actual physical revision, and so OSs are sort of more responsible for dealing with it, at least in the short term. All right, any other meltdown or questions on this type of issue? Okay, so our issue is that, getting back to this issue of the branch, right, that we're able to do something even if the branch shouldn't have been taken or we shouldn't have executed that if statement. And as we talked about earlier, we can sort of influence what's likely to happen by giving the processor many examples of what we want it to think. So we want it to think that the branch is going to be taken, that if will be predicted, that something will be predicted as true and we'll execute that if. And so that when we get to the case where we actually give it something where it's not true, The processor still thinks it is because it's been true every other time in the past. Why would it be different this time? And executes the instructions it wasn't supposed to. Okay, so what else can we do with this sort of speculative execution? Right? What else can we put here? Or how can we continue to kind of build this attack set so that we can use this to learn more than we should? And so the second paper, the Spectre paper, looked at an attack that looks like what you see here. And the idea is that if this code is running somewhere that has extra privileges, so like in a system call handler, or we'll also see an example from a web browser, but X is something that the attacker chooses. So X is like the input. Right, now if you look at this code, you look and you go, huh, okay. Well, X is an input, so we don't know exactly what that's going to be. But we're going to use X to index into this array, which, you know, is fine as long as we make sure that X doesn't go beyond the end of the array. So we do that check. And then, you know, we populated array 1, so we know what the values are, so we know that this lookup here into array 2 will be fine as well. That's, you know, reasonable code. But of course, you know, as we've been talking about, like, well, this check just means that the ultimately visible operation won't do this array lookup. It doesn't mean that the processor internally won't. Okay, so how can we use this? So if we have some secret value at some memory address, for example, and we want to be able to learn what that is, and specifically, we want to know what the value is. And so our goal then is to use the value of secret, which we can observe directly, as the index into array 2, or at least part of it. And so then depending on which cache row or set is affected, that will give us some hint as to what the value actually was. So if we want array 1 of X to be that value, what do we make X? Well, we know where X starts, right, which is here. And so this is just a character array, so we basically just want to take the difference of these two, right? So we'll subtract those two, and then whatever that value is, that becomes X. And so then the processor will try to access, hopefully access that memory at that address, which will then contain the value that we're interested in, to place here so that it affects our second lookup in array 2. Okay, so once we do that, so now if we know that, so we have a cache, right? So we're gonna use 64 byte blocks and it's got 8,192 sets. If array 2, so the beginning of array 2 is in cache set 0. So it's kind of the nice case, right? Like the array just happens to be aligned and the address will go to the first set in the cache. And if what we observe in our probe step, or the second step of our cache timing attack, that we learn that cache set 128 was evicted, What then do we know about the value of array one indexed to x? So I'll give you 3 minutes, chat with your neighbors. What's that value going to be? All right, what do you think? What value could array one indexed by x be? Any thoughts? Any guesses? No takers? All right. So let's see if we can figure this out. So what we know is that whatever this was had to index somewhere that would have that would go to cache set 128. Well, because we know the array starts at the start of the array maps to the start of the cache, so it has index 0. Basically, whatever this value is, however many blocks it is in, will be the cache set index. So if we take array x times 4096, and then we divide that by the size of our block, that's how many blocks in will be, or how many cache sets in will be. And so this works out to 64. And then we know we want that to equal 128. So then this value is 2. Okay, so that's sort of the idea here, right? We used X to target a particular memory address that we want to look at. We don't know what the value is. We're not supposed to know what the value is. But when the processor was trying to execute these instructions speculatively, it did the lookup anyways. It got the value of 2. And then it used that to index into another array, which changed the cache, which we could observe. And so we can figure out that that memory, what's pointed to at that, by that memory address, is this like number 2. Anyone get anything else? Right. That's exactly the right intuition. Right, our cache is only so big. And so if the value is bigger and we go farther into that second array, we're going to essentially wrap around in the cache because we only have this many sets. The effect of that then is if we increase this by a multiple of 128, we'll get back to that same cache index. So we actually have the answer could be 2, it could be 130, and so on. So we get sort of like some granularity there about what that value is. Because we're multiplying by 64. Yeah. All right. So that's, basically the answer is there. So to do this, right, with something that can access that array, what we would want is there to be some code in the kernel, right, like a system call handler that's doing effectively this, that has this structure. So we have this if statement, so something can execute speculatively, right? Because that's really important, because if there's nothing sort of for the processor to guess, it just won't do the, won't have to do this speculative execution. And so then to exploit that, what we're going to do is, like we talked about, first we're gonna try to call that system call handler many, many times, with a value that has that trains the branch predictor to take the version of the jump, or in this case, to execute that if statement every single time. Right, so we'll call it with the value that was more intended, right? Something that fits in that array. Do that a bunch of times. Then we go to sort of our normal flow of priming the cache, then calling the system call handler with something that isn't within that array bounds, but is what we're interested in knowing, right? We're trying to learn this target address. So we take that relative to where the array address starts. Then we do our probe step, where we try to figure out, okay, what changed in the cache because of that, before eventually the processor realizes, like, oh, wait a minute, I wasn't supposed to run that if statement, so I'm going to return, an error or something. And then we use that knowledge about the cache to figure out what the actual value was. So this is basically how this type of attack works. Good with that? Any questions? So, we've been looking at this like 4096 value because it's nice for the cache example we're using. This shifts things over so that the smaller bits of the value we're looking for are actually going to be visible. because they will be, you'll show up as different cash rows that are evicted. But we may not always get that, and so even if we have something where the code that's in say that system call handler doesn't quite look the same way, then we're going to get sort of different bits about X. But that's okay, because we can shift the address we're looking for. So if we actually want to know something about this address, well, we can shift what we actually are interested in sort of a little bit earlier so that we actually observe is the part of the value that's at the higher bits. Because the lower bits then are just going to get lost in like, well, we don't know exactly which cache offset it was. But we'll be able to tell which cache row it was. And so that will tell us something about those upper bytes. The other thing is that we need just this general structure to exist in that privileged code. So something like this, right? The top is our template that we've been using. Looks something like that. And the question is, okay, but can we actually find something where when we go to look at that array, we don't get a seg fault because it does have permissions to actually look at that memory, even if it is just speculative. Now, it won't actually return that memory to us because the if statement protects that, but we still need this sort of structure somewhere. Well, it turns out that this is not that sort of unreasonable of a construction, right? Because if we have something where in actual code, we have a table that we want to index into, and then that gives us something that we then use to look up in another table, right, that's exactly what we're trying to do here, right? So we have our if statement because we need to protect that we're taking whatever's coming in from user space, right? So we have to check to make sure that that's valid. So we make sure that fits in our table, and then from the programmer's point of view, it's like, okay, if it's not, then we return and we're good. And if it is okay, then we look up in that first array, or in this case, the table, and then use that value to look up in a second array or a different table. And so it is actually possible to find constructs that look like this template we want. And I think it's important to remember that, like, from the programmer's point of view, the OS point of view, you know, this is exactly what they intended. Like, this isn't like a bug in the code. But if you're not sort of thinking about, like, well, what's actually happening at the processor? Like, what could the processor do with these instructions? Which, of course, you know, we're not, right? We're not thinking about that. Because, like, programming's hard enough. Much less trying to track through, okay, what could the, you know, what if the execute stage was happening at this time? You know, it's like, that's a total different layer of abstraction. But that's why, you know, having expertise in these different layers of the computing stack means that when this problem is presented, we can sort of make sense of it. And figure out, like, okay, wait a minute, actually this code could have this potential vulnerability. Any questions on this? Okay, so let's try, see if we can figure out what the value of mystery is if we have this speculative execution on this other array with this cache setup. So again, we have our 64 byte blocks and our total 64 KB cache. And we notice that this thing is slow, that index. What is the value of mystery? So we'll take three and a half minutes. Again, consult your colleagues, and then we'll see what we come up with. Any ideas? Any thoughts on what mystery is? Or what mystery might be? So the first thing we have to do is we want to figure out which cash index was actually slow, right? So we know that this thing was slow to access, and if it was this index, OX800, and we have 64 byte blocks, so we divide this by 64, that actually gives us 32. So then we know that, okay, so it was cache index 32 that was slow. So that must be the same one that this accessed as well. Okay, so that's kind of the first step here. So we know this maps to cache index 32. We can also calculate the number of sets. And then we know that this must be access at the same index. But because we're multiplying by block size, right, that's kind of the opposite of what we just did. So we divided by block size to get 32. And so if mystery is 32, then we'll be at that same offset relative in the same cache index. But we have to take into account that the cache will sort of like, we get that wraparound, right? And so what we really want is we want something that's that includes this mod num sets. Because if we get back to the beginning, then we can wrap around and hit 32 as well. And so when we take that into account, so the zero here, so this access of X will be zero because that's where the array started. So when we're not doing an offset from the beginning of the array, whatever X is divided by block size, but then mod the total number of sets. And so when we plug X into here, we cancel out the block sizes, the zero doesn't do anything. And so we get 32, but it can be plus or minus any multiple of this 1024. Yeah, here, yeah. So because other array started at like address 0x400000, you know, if we actually go in and look at the bits of where that's gonna map to the cache index bits, those bits will be all zero. So the first entry in that array is gonna map to the cache index zero, which then we use here as our sort of starting offset. All right. So the slides have sort of another explanation that kind of goes like we were saying last time, looking at the different bits. this will also work even if the n is not block, or what we're multiplying by in that array lookup is not actually a block size, right? It could be n, you can look at you know, how that's calculated. It's very similar. Similarly, also, if the array doesn't start at something with a bunch of zeros at the end, right, but starts at some other address, that's going to change kind of that starting point, right? Because we can look at like the bits here. So those are the offset bits. And for a direct map cache, we're going to have 10 index bits. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Right, and this will be 1 and then 5. So that's going to be the, so if we're at index 0 in that array, we'll actually be at cache index 51, and that just changes kind of our starting point here. So same idea, we're still going to have the wraparound, just going to start at a different point. So these attacks are viable even if we don't get exactly the sort of setup or exactly the code that we have talked about. What about an associative cache? So we've been talking about direct map cache. Will this still work if the processor happens to have an associative cache? The answer is yes. But we're losing a little bit of resolution, right? Because if we have the same size cache with the same size blocks, but it's now two-way, basically we've shrunk our index bits by one. So the starting point is still 32, because that's still going to be, with the same size blocks, that's still going to be where we're first, or the sort of the kind of common value of mystery to index into that cache. But now because we have two-way and 9 index bits instead of 10, our offsets, we're going to wrap around 512 instead of 1024. So we basically have more possibilities for what the value could actually be, and we're sort of losing resolution on what we're learning. And to sort of illustrate that again, if we have a different index, which is slow, and we look at what this is in binary, so we'll get 1, 0, 0. So our index of this, now we still have the 6 bits for offset, but now we only have 9 bits. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 for the index. And so this becomes just a tag bit, and so we basically have the same wraparound. So we still get our 32 with the 512 offset, just as we saw before. Essentially, we're just, again, looping around. So that's kind of like, again, we're losing that resolution. Any questions on this? Could it be plus or minus 512? Yeah, it's that, yeah. Okay, so what happens if we have a four-way associative cache? So we have the same cache set 32 that's evicted. Let's take maybe 2 minutes. All right, any takers for A? How about B? C? D? E? It's not up there. F? Don't know. Okay, so what's happening with a four-way set associative cache? So we're basically, assuming, in this case, again, we're keeping it the same size. So we have the total amount of storage, but by having more ways per set, we're basically reducing the number of sets that we have. And so we still have 6 bits for the blocks. This is still 2 to the 16. Except now we have 4 ways, so this is going to be 2 to the 2, or basically 2 bits for that. So that means now we're now down to 8 index bits. And so if we look at something like, let's just look at this one, right? Okay, so we know that that is also still in the, we'll say, okay, so we want something that still divides by 32, so either one of these will work. We can take the left one, I guess. So we'll have 0, all zeros. Okay, and then we still have our 6 for the offset. We have 8 here, so 1, 2, 3, 4, 6, 7, 8. So this is our index. And so anything with that index is going to map to that same index 32 being evicted. But then these sort of remaining bits here are just become tag bits. So those could be 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, 1, 1, right? And they would all still map to the same cache index. And so that's going to be C here. All right, any questions? All right, cool. So point is that the cache type doesn't matter. I mean, it affects how the calculation is done, but the attack is still viable. The starting point doesn't matter. The multiplication factor doesn't fix this, right? The idea still holds in any case. But like we mentioned, we need some way to tell what's happening, and we talked about prime and probe. And the idea there was we fill the cache with something, we run, something happens, and we see what's no longer fast. Evict and reload is similar, but kind of the opposite, where we start by clearing the cache, making sure that what we're interested in is not in the cache by loading something else. Then we let something happen. And then afterwards we check, okay, what in that array is now fast? Because remember, we made sure it wasn't in the cache, so whatever got pulled back in the cache, that must be what we're interested in. That must be what happened here. And so, again, it's very similar in sort of what's going on. It's just that in practice, it turns out that this can often be easier to actually set up and use than the prime and probe example. And so we can use this technique for the meltdown exploit. Here we have our probe array. We make sure that none of that is in the cache. We then load something from a kernel address that we're not allowed to access. But before the processor realizes that, we calculate something on that value and then use that to look up into probe array. That's going to change the cache when we get the fault, and then we can look at, okay, wait, what changed in the cache, right? What must have this value been because of how it affected ProBeret, since I knew that nothing, no part of it would have been in the cash originally. All right. In the examples we've seen so far, we've been sort of talking about like user space versus kernel space. Another example that the researchers looked at in the paper was the case of web browsers. So web browsers have a similar kind of idea where we want each web page to be able to execute some code. It should sort of execute in kind of its own sandbox, and it doesn't have access to other web pages. It also doesn't have access to like the browser's internal state itself. But what's interesting about the case in JavaScript is that the whole point is that the web page is bringing its own code with it. And so it turns out that it doesn't actually need to be able to find that kind of template code in the browser. It can actually just include it itself. And so the example in the paper is shown here, where because the JavaScript is compiled just in time by the browser, if we have some array with some length and we try to index, you know, way above it, right? So like most of the time, again, so like same kind of thing would apply, right? Normally we'd run this bunch of times and say, like this should be fine, this if statement is gonna evaluate to true, train the branch predictor. Then we go and say, okay, let me use a much larger index. That's gonna cause it to run speculatively. Well, it's gonna run speculatively either way, but it's gonna be false the second time. Then whatever is pointed to by that memory, we then use inside of our array lookup here, and that changes the cache. And then based on seeing what's evicted by this access here, you know, we can then tell, like, okay, what was that value pointed to at the, you know, somewhere way at the end of that array before the system realizes, like, wait a minute, like, that if statement did actually fail, it shouldn't have run that, you know, and this code won't have those observable effects except for the cache that changed. Okay. So that's a case where we can supply our own attack code. There's another type of attack that's similar, that's also part of the original Spectre paper, where we're not just looking at whether a branch was taken or not taken, but in this case, we're looking at what the target of the branch is. So we have this jump statement, for example, and that's gonna go to somewhere, but that somewhere is dynamic, right? Depends on what the value of RAX is. And so just like we saw with the branch predictor, taken, not taken, the CPU still wants to guess. It wants to get a value for that so that it can jump there and start executing more instructions. That way it doesn't have to just sort of wait around. And how does it do that? Well, very similar to the branch predicting idea, is that we're going to kind of look at previous examples and keep track of them. And probably, like what we looked at before, is, or where we jumped before, is probably where we'll jump in the future. And so, just like the branch, whether the branch is taken or not, we can also train this branch predictor with the value that we want it to speculate. So if we can find some function that looks like this, or some, you know, some assembly instruction that has that, and then get the processor to believe that RAX is you know, a specific value that we care about, then we can get it to speculatively jump to that location and start executing things there, which then might have these microarchitectural like side effects, right? They might change the cache, before the processor realizes, like, oh, actually, it shouldn't have, you know, it shouldn't have jumped there. That wasn't the right location. Okay, so these are the sort of two main variants from the Spectre paper. That's the kind of the name, again, the name that the researchers gave it when they detected, found this issue. This kind of sparked an entire sort of a lot of, like, inspection into this idea. Because it's one of these things where, like, once it's kind of pointed out to you, you're like, oh, yeah, maybe this whole idea of, like, speculating things that never actually happened could lead to problems. But it hadn't really been looked at it that way. And so kind of any time we have this case where we're doing something and we're sort of guessing, if there's any remnant anywhere else in the processor where the evidence of that might be visible, there's a potential that this kind of issue could arise. And so there's a variety of other variations that are mentioned in the paper or in follow-on papers that if you're interested in, we can talk more about. And then finally, you know, what can we kind of do about this, right? So one thing, and what's happened since these papers, is that the hardware has changed to avoid making these effects visible. In the meantime, mitigations like this are also possible, right? So when we had this array index lookup, the problem was that we did the check as an if statement before it, just like we always would. But then that lets the processor do the speculation. If, however, we make the computation of the index something that has no jumps in it, right? So compute mask looks like this, where we use this subtract with borrow instruction to kind of do that same thing of making sure that we're not indexing something we shouldn't, then the processor has to execute those instructions before it knows where to go in array. Like with the speculative case, it had the value. Like it had x, and so it could go and try it. Here, now with compute with mask, it doesn't actually know the value until it's done all of that, and then at that point, it's no longer what the attacker wanted. And so now it becomes like, so with this kind of defense, it becomes a matter of like making sure that you never have the, you know, this case where you're doing this array access and making sure that all of the cases are checked, which is in the size of like an entire operating system can be difficult. For the indirect branches, again, there's some mitigations. You could have sort of separate predictors so that the user space application can't train the predictor. A sort of a short-term fix in software is to avoid this construct altogether and replace it with some different assembly that is safer. And so for an example of that, and you can read more about this by looking up this retpylene. But the idea of rather than just do this jump directly, we're going to basically replace it with this assembly block you see here. And kind of the, you know, at a high level, the idea is that you know, this function call is going to get us down here, and this is where we actually figure out what RAX actually is and then jump to it. In the meantime, the processor, if the processor speculates, it's going to speculate here. That's what ends up happening. And so it'll just sort of sit in this loop until it realizes, like, oh, actually, no, RAX was something else. So rather than jump to what the attacker wants, it just sort of sits in this local loop. So it's just another way of kind of making one instruction a bunch of instructions so that the process is that this attack isn't possible, that there's no, that the speculation doesn't happen in the same way. All right. So just a couple examples of some mitigations. That's where we're going to leave this discussion. Reminder on Tuesday, please prepare questions. We'll answer questions as long as you have them. And then the exam is on Friday. All right, thanks, everyone.